Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me this evening is my good friend and co-host,
Chad Metz.
Or is it Chad Metz? Is it secretly a scroll pretending to be Chad Metz, who is hosting, co-hosting this podcast? Do I need to cut your finger off in order to verify your identity?
Okay, I'm going
to
stop you right there because I still haven't seen the second episode yet. As soon as we're done, I'm going to watch it. I've only seen the first one.
All right. That is indeed Chad Metz. I am Brian C. Wood, and this is the Movies on the Brain podcast. So, Chad, Marvel does AI, or assisted AI, as one might say, and causes the entirety of the Hollywood machine to blow up and disintegrate. Your thoughts, sir, on the AI controversy or lack thereof with Marvel?
So in general, like we're in a weird place with AI because, you know, people that I know that are smarter than me, that know more than me are like, you know, it's here. There's nothing to do it. But as the, you know, the information professional that I am, a lot of what people are saying is AI is more like machine learning. Which is, it's not true AI in the sense everybody's thinking of where, you know, the computers are doing things on their own. It's machines learning from stuff and producing stuff. It is a form of AI, but, you know, it's not what people think it is per se yet. So all that to say, I know AI is going to be a tool in making movies and every process of making movies going forward. What I think, and I know what it's what the writers are fighting for. It's probably if the directors had, you know, more gumption, it would probably be what they should be fighting for, is to have more hands on how it's used in the process and not have that dictated to it. So using it to assist in what these humans are doing, I'd be the writers, the producers, the directors, whatever, to assist in making the art they're producing better. I think that's the way we want to go. So with the Marvel controversy, on one hand, as soon as you hear it, it's like, why would they do that? Especially knowing everything that's going on around AI right now. You know, the writers are on strike. You know, their reputation with comic artists and paying people is not the best right now. Why would you even do it? But then when you hear deeper into the story that it's the company that they hired and that they use the AI to help, like, to do this, it seems like they're using it in the fashion that to assist from what I gather when I look further into it. So it's not as bad, but it's the whole just saying AI right now in this space is a hot button issue. So that's kind of a misstep. But I do think it's kind of, in this instance, I think it's kind of overblown because they didn't just straight up use AI. They did hire a company. The company used it to gather these, to gather and then create these images. But you can't say AI right now and not have a reaction. I mean, I get what the company was going for. They wanted something disorienting and to feel kind of like off. And with the theme of the show, that kind of fits what you want. But then on the other hand, it's like you could have just paid somebody, a human, to do this kind of stuff. So it's a sticky wicket. But I do think it's slightly overblown. But I do understand why everybody's overblowing it.
Because I think that the Writers Guild, to their credit, and hopefully soon the actors, to their credit, have really drawn a hard line in the sand in regards to AI, in the sense that they've made it seem like the studios are holding AI above their heads as a overlord replacement, that, you know, AI will just do the writer's job and the writers will no longer be needed and they can all just go and, you know, be bombed by Oppenheimer. And that's not quite the reality of the situation. As far as like what AI can do at this particular moment, it is more assistive technology or AT and less AI to me, the way that it's being applied, especially in this particular case. The problem here is it's Marvel. It's the biggest brand in Hollywood. It's Disney, the biggest brand in marketing. And it's in the middle of we're 8 weeks in, 10 weeks into the writer's strike now. We're entering into the phase where the actors will make a decision about whether or not to join. And if the actors decide to join at that point, then all of Hollywood shuts down because, you know, no actors, no writers, directors can't do their whole thing themselves. So it'll be interesting to see, but like you can't, like I get why he goes out and the director goes out and he starts publicizing this and talking about the process. But I think the AI aspect of it really just gets put in a different context with what's going on right now. Because what they did was they assisted; they didn't create.
Yes, and when people actually like stop and hear that, I think it is if you accept the fact that, you know, AI machine learning is here, the way that they use it, the assisting part, that is kind of what you hope for. But that's not what. That's not what people hear first. They just hear Marvel use AI, and I understand everybody's reaction. I get it, because then when I first read it, I'm like, "Well, that's mighty dumb of you, Marvel, especially right now." But again, if you read further than the headline and you have some kind of understanding of it, you understand that it's not. This is kind of the route you want it to go, but it's just not the right time. The climate is too hot for it right now.
Agreed. So I put out a tweet last week that you were curious about. And I think that this will be the perfect opportunity for me to explore that tweet a little bit more in depth. I tweeted something to the extent of, for the first time since Zemo, I really like care for and get a Marvel villain's motivations. And I sympathize with them. And you were kind of had a question mark there, but it's all regarding Secret Wars Secret Invasion, and when you get to the second episode, you will fully understand what they're talking about. So like, I'm the guy who loves the last episode of season one of Loki because it's basically Kang presenting a case about foreign diplomacy. You know, do we kill the dictator? Or do we let the dictator live and prop him up so that chaos doesn't ensue? It's a very deep foreign policy discussion that never really gets had, even when we do regime change and assist in regime change. We don't really have those kind of deep political science foreign policy discussions. And this was them basically having the Iraq war discussion on a television show. And I loved that. In politics, there's a, there have been many incumbent people running for re-election, incumbents running for re-election, who have used the catchphrase or the slogan "promises kept," and it's supposedly, you know, a way to brand that. Look at all the wonderful things that I promised I was going to do once I got into office, and look at all the things I actually followed through on. Now, generally, at the federal level, you're talking about like one or two major pieces of legislation, and people forget about half the promises you didn't keep. Secret Invasion is strictly in its antagonist is slowly motivated by broken promises. And I actually think that's one of the, to that effect, I actually think it's the title of the second episode. The idea of the pact that Nick Fury makes with Talos and with the Skrull people at the end of the Captain Marvel film serves as a principal core meaning for this television series. Because at the end of Captain Marvel, Fury and Carol Danvers promised to go find the Skrulls a new home. And they never follow through on it. Like, Fury enlists the Skrulls to help him with his little side quest missions and intelligence gathering and reconnaissance and all this stuff. But he never really, like, goes back and fulfills that promise. Carol Danvers, to the best of our knowledge, what little we've seen of her since Captain Marvel, hasn't really embraced that either. Like, we haven't seen her on any kind of mission or side quest to go find a planet. So the show becomes a political science dissertation on foreign policy again, in the sense that, you know, we come into these nations and we bulldoze them. And we take out the dictators and the despots and we make them all kinds of promises about, you know, entreating democracy, implementing democracy, and free and fair elections, and government assistance programs, and all these new roads and bridges, and all these things that we purport to these people that we're going to do, and they're completely dependent upon us to follow through with our obligations. And when we don't, we end up leaving them in a situation that is actually far worse than, you know, where they were beforehand. And that reputation gives way to a lot of ill will toward the United States and toward our government and toward our foreign policy as it relates to interventionalism, that gets used by our enemies as propaganda. You know, look at these bad things that the United States has done, that kind of thing. It's while we will never fully be the shining city on the hill, it's why we always aspire to be, because we want to be a true beacon of light and a leader in the world. But like in Secret Invasion, it's more of, you understand and you get what Bingsley King Adair's character is going through and what the Skrull people as a whole are going through, because it's split. It's split between people who are still loyal to Nick Fury and still loyal to him despite him not keeping his promise. And there are those who are like, okay, screw it. They're not going to give us a home. They're not going to go find us another planet. They're not going to do these things that they promised for us. Then screw them. We'll take this planet and we'll make it ours. And, you know, in order for us to really live and sustain this way, kind of need nuclear power. So like, you know, a nuclear war wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing for us. May make the planet a little bit more hospitable. And so you get to that place where this is a guy whose parents died in the original conflict for the Kree-Skrull War. He's homeless and he's taken in by this encampment on Earth. He hears Nick Fury basically say, you know, you keep your word and I'll keep mine. And then they keep waiting. And then he finally just gets pissed off enough to lead a rebellious sect and be like, screw it. And I can totally understand and sympathize, not with, you know, the idea of starting a nuclear war to get what you need, but like the idea that this person, this entity, this system has failed you. It has let you down. And you now have to take command of the institution to get what you need done. And that's, you know, that's a powerful geopolitical, political science, foreign policy theory to see unveiled in a Marvel film or a Marvel television series. And that's what I like about Zemo. Zemo isn't, you know, amazing or awesome or brutal or strong. Its plan is to basically tell Tony Stark the lie, the truth, when Captain America has been hiding it from him. You know, so like it's just interesting to me, and I sympathize with Bingsley King Adair. Is doing an amazing job, and especially episode 2 really deepens the levels of which his Fury's betrayal has hurt him personally. And I just think I can't wait to see where the show goes, because it leads directly into Armor Wars, obviously. So
yeah, I wish I was able to watch the second episode before we recorded, but yeah, I'm rectifying that as soon as we get off. I won't say too much since I haven't seen much of it. I do think it's interesting that you said, you know, that it leads directly into Armor Wars, only because I had a conversation with my brother about it, I think yesterday before the new one. And I was telling him my theories on how the show leads into Armor Wars.
Which you've been on the Rhodey as a Skrull train for a long time.
Yes, yes. And even more, okay, outside of like story reasons, but constructing a story reason. You have to have people that you've seen be a Skrull. You have to have people that you've seen for a while be a Skrull. As of now, the only three people that have been, that we know, if you've only seen the first episode like me, that we know have been around for a while, are Nick Fury, Maria Hill, and Rhodey. Well, you've seen the first episode. You know Maria Hill is gone off of the board unless something, you know, happens that, in the second episode, but off the first episode, she's gone. We strongly believe that Nick Fury is not a Skrull, because he is Nick Fury. He is the main character of the show. So
there's a big plot twist there at the end of episode two, but yes.
Okay. So with that being said, that leaves Process Elimination. It leaves Rhodey. And knowing that Don Cheadle has talked about that this show leads into Armor Wars, it just makes me believe that the Rhodey that we see is a Skrull. Don't know how long he's been a Skrull, but once we get to Armor Wars, it will be Rhodey proper, and he will be dealing with what Skrull Rhodey's been doing, along with whatever's going on with people trying to jack Tony stuff.
Well, and also, you know, New World Order can lead into that. And by the way, Thunderbolt started filming today. So
did they actually started?
Yep. They moved it to Christmas, I think. But yeah.
Yeah, they pushed everything back because of the writer's strike. And, you know, the way things are looking, it's really curious that they started. Well, from what I've heard, the actors will probably get an extension before they go on strike, because if they go on strike, by the letter of their contract, they go on strike on Friday. But I hear they're going to have some kind of extension to see if they can get something worked out, and then they'll go on strike. So it's still going to be within like the month. So
most industry projections were for the strike in general to last into the fall. Which once you get past August and September, then you're really in a crunch.
Yeah, the last thing I heard from somebody, they said they think it's going to go into October, which is wild. But it's just going to hurt the studios. They're pushing everything back. They're not going to be any damn movies for the summer. Not any of their big ones, because they can't do anything.
The power of negotiation.
Yeah, well, they can, you know, they'll do whatever. But
the show is really, really good and thematically rich, and people are comparing it to Andor. Andor is a completely different thing. You know that character is going to die. It's really just about leading to the place and getting him into the headspace where we first meet him in Rogue One. And that's, you know, it's really interesting, and it tackles some dramatic themes, and it really digs into the rebellion and what a true rebellion looks like, because not everybody can be, you know, Leia or Han Solo and not get their hands dirty. Like, a lot of folks have to be on the ground actually fighting the battle as rebels. And Andor does a really good job of depicting that side of the Star Wars canon. This is just this is Winter Soldier level geopolitical thriller. And it really works for me because, again, like, there have been plenty of examples of us as a country letting other countries down and letting other people down. And it's, you know, it's nice to see Old Man Fury, as some have called him, you know, have to face the reckoning of that, and the reckoning of his mission away and not being on a space station and not being physically present here the way that, you know, he was before the events of the blip. So
I'm looking forward to see how this goes. I shall find out soon enough.
Yeah, there's a conversation between Rhodes and Fury that you're going to get a real kick out of, and I'll be interested to hear what your take is on the twist at the end of the episode. But yeah, it's they're doing some really great work over there on Secret Invasion, and I'm glad that it's working out. Now, on the other hand, you know, comments from Anthony Mackie about our boy Jonathan Majors, not so much.
Okay, so I saw he had comments about Jonathan Majors, and because it's Anthony Mackie and because it's Jonathan Majors, I'm like, you know what? I'm not reading these comments. I'm just not going to do it, because 9 times out of 10, he's going to say something that I don't agree with. How bad it's going to be, I don't know. So I'm just not going to look at it. But now you're going to tell me what he said, and then I'll have to judge my frustration with him accordingly.
He said everybody is innocent until proven guilty. Ain't no one proved nothing against that dude yet. So,
okay. So his statement is factually accurate. The guy is going to court, has not had his day in court. Nothing has been proven against him. They are all allegations. I get that. And you know what? In the grand scheme of things, he's fine. Well, I'm not going to say he's fine to say that, but he could have said some more outlandish stuff than that. So him only sticking to the, he's basically sticking to the, I'm going to let the justice system play out. Okay, that's fine. But the whole issue is the whole thing is sticky just because Again, it's a domestic violence dispute. It's allegations that a man physically assaulted a woman, and you know, and if you know the statistics, statistically, women don't speak up because they fear retribution, they fear not being believed, and all those things are borne out to be true. And the vast majority of women that make allegations are telling the truth. So it's that kind of thing where if you want to acknowledge that women have been dealt a poor hand in this, and that the very least we can do is acknowledge what they're saying is true. But we also have processes where, you know, guilty until proven innocent. So I think what he's saying is like the safest thing to say in his position, because he probably knows old boy too. So he knows the guy. He don't want to talk too bad about him, but it's like, it sounds like, you know, if they say he did it, he'll be like, well. But if they say he didn't do it, he'll be like, well. So I get it. I'm not going to get upset about it. But I know other people can get their knickers in a bunch from this. But, you know, it's whatever you want to do. I understand the position we're in.
Indeed. Speaking of positions we are in, we are watching the death spiral of the Zack Snyder-born DCEU.
Okay.
And it is burning to the ground like Rome under Nero. Sir, your thoughts on the Flash's continued descent into Dante's Inferno?
Okay. So before I start, are we going to just do all the WB stuff like right now?
Yes, let's do that. And also let's promote your episode of the podcast where y'all cover the Man of Steel history extensively.
Okay, so I will first start with just, like, we haven't talked about The Flash, the movie itself, at all since this came out. Which, if you listen to us for any amount of time, that should tell you something all within its own. You still haven't seen it yet, have you?
I've seen it on Twitter.
Okay, so officially, only one of us has seen it. So briefly, my thoughts on the movie, I think it is fine. I think there are some very good points. The very good parts have nothing to do with The Flash, nothing to do with what he can do, is everything about the relationship between Barry and his mother. I think those are the best parts. Take into consideration that at this point in my life, I am a very mom softy person with movies. So you put a mom in there, particularly if you're going to put a mom in there and something bad is going to happen to mom, you've already got me like in a position where I'm not going to say a lot of bad stuff about that part. But even taking that, I think those are the best parts of the movie. If you liked Ezra Miller in the other movies that he's been The Flash, you'll probably like this. If you don't like Ezra Miller as The Flash, you probably won't like this. I don't like his portrayal of Barry Allen. But I can acknowledge that his performance as Barry Allen in this movie is very good. I think they went for Barry Allen being the way they're playing him, particularly in this one. They all but say that they're playing him as someone that is, I don't know the correct term. I'm going to say neurodivergent, but that might not be the right term. Don't hate me. Just tell me the right term and I'll try to get better next time. But I think they're trying to play him as somebody that's like on the spectrum. And knowing that that's the way they're playing him, I can see it. I can appreciate it. That kind of, you don't get that kind of representation in a superhero movie. So I think that is good. I think his performance like that is good. When I think of Barry Allen, the way that he plays him is not the way that I think of it. So, but the movie itself is just fine. It hangs a lot on nostalgia. Some of it works, some of it doesn't. There are a lot of Back to Future jokes in here that, unless you're of a certain age, you will not get. Case in point, I was sitting right next to my daughter, who was just kind of there with me to watch this one. And the Back to the Future jokes almost all revolve around Eric Stoltz. If you don't know who Eric Stoltz is or his relation to Back to the Future, you have no idea what these jokes are. So I'm sitting there laughing and she's like, what is this? And I have to explain it to her. So the movie's fine. Okay, with it being fine, the box office has said that this movie is a dumpster fire because nobody's going to see it. It is cratering at the box office.
It is cratering while Elementals makes a run back up the charts.
Right. And I think that's the most damning thing about it, is because they both opened the same weekend. Flash was supposed to be the number one movie. It was, with way lower than expected results. Elementals was supposed to, like, you know, it's a Pixar movie, and it's doing, it did worse than Lightyear last year. And I mean, another day we could talk about the way Disney trained people to expect Pixar movies in the future. But if they didn't come out the same week, Elementals would have been the story of whatever week he came out and been like, this is the end of Pixar. They can't get a movie to open well, blah, blah, blah. But then this week comes around and Elementals second week, granted, it's still not making the money that you would think a Pixar movie makes, but it's not even holding steady. The legs are very good on it. It dropped less than 40%, which is spectacular for this kind of movie. Whereas The Flash dropped 72% from an already dismal opening weekend. The box office for this movie says that it is trash. It is not trash. But what it tells me is that the general audience does not respect the DC brand. They see the DC brand, they see that DC logo, and they think it's trash. And they're just not going to go see it. And you can, and unless it's Batman, and, you know, I think it's even ding Batman some, because the Batman opened, I think it's less than 800 million, which I think that movie, I don't think it should have hit a billion, but I think it should have done over 8. So I think it's ding that just a little bit too. But unless you're Batman, the box office results have been steadily declining for like the last 2 years. And that's just because people are like, they see DC as not a mark of quality. And that is my biggest concern coming out of The Flash. I can care less about what people think of the movie. I can care less about how much money this movie makes, except its overall value to the brand of DC. And I know we hate talking about brands, so we're talking about movies and arts, but DC is a brand. It's always been a brand. And you're trying to restart this brand, this universe. And I think they have good people involved. But the audience, not the fan audience, the general audience has said, we don't care. And they've said it like, this is the biggest we don't care I can think of since we've really been doing this. Even like the Fox X-Men movies, people didn't say they didn't care like they're saying it with this. The Fox movies was a steady decline, but they were like, we'll baseline it, but we're not really messing with it. Transformers is probably the closest thing, but even that is still not like such a precipitous fall.
We're talking about Green Lantern numbers,
which is worse. They're on face value, they're comparable number, but Green Lantern didn't fall on his face like this. And Green Lantern is like 13 years ago, so it's even worse because these numbers are the money is worth more now than it was back then. There's really nothing comparable to what The Flash is. And it's really funny because when we were talking online before we started, I said, they pulled Batgirl, and it was said Batgirl, releasing that would have been damaging to the brand of DC.
And a financial disaster.
And a financial disaster. But this movie has done irreparable harm to DC. It is what they claim Batgirl would be. So I don't even need to, like, we don't even need to really talk about the movie anymore. It is what it is. It will be remembered as a bomb, and only that. It will be forgotten by everything else. But it is now it's the concern is, how can you rebuild some trust in the audience to even get them to come into the theater to see Superman Legacy? Superman Legacy can be spectacular. It can be the best superhero movie ever. And I think it will have to be the best superhero movie ever to get people to willingly come back in there. But DC can't count on that. They have to put in work to get people to want to come and see their product. I don't know how they do that. I don't know what you do to get them in. And I'm saying all that considering there's still two more movies that come out this year that you've got to do something with. Blue Beetle, I'm not as concerned with, outside of the fact that it's going to have the Mark of Death, which is the DC shield on it. I think you can get by with that one because it's not as expensive. But Aquaman is going to be this another big, massive, expensive movie. And are people going to come out and support it like they did the first one? Or is it going to be something closer to The Flash? Even if they don't support it like the first one, but if it's closer to, I don't think it'll be The Flash, but if it's closer to The Flash, it is, then you got major, major problems. And I don't know how they fix it.
It's public relations. It's brand ambassadoring. It's putting people out there to talk. I mean, it's just, there's not a whole lot of ways to turn that ship around when it gets to this point. And I've seen a lot of talk online about how, you know, the gun announcement sunk any kind of possibilities for Shazam and Black Adam and Flash to do well. And I'm like, no. Like, yeah, for guys like me and you, we know that that James Gunn's making a Superman movie and that he's cast a couple of key roles and that the movie's supposed to start shooting and come out in 2025. And we know all these things because we play in this space. Sally Mae in Hawkins, Ohio, doesn't keep up with it on that level. And she's the target demographic for this movie, especially when she sees old-ass Michael Keaton doing the exact opposite of what he did in Birdman, where he made fun of all this stuff, and now he's back. You know, like, we know this stuff. We know that the DCEU is ending. We know that whatever James Gunn does from here on out is the way. They've already said the Blue Beetle would be the official start of it, yada, yada. But the general public doesn't know that. So if they don't know that these movies don't count toward anything, they're just responding to the fact that they're not very good movies. And that in some cases, like with Shazam, you took too long to make a sequel. And you didn't really make the sequel that people were promised at the end of the first one. The Flash has been in the works since 2012. Like, it's just bands eventually. I don't think it was the Ezra Miller of it. I don't think it was the Keaton of it. I don't think it was the Affleck of it. I don't think it was the bad CGI effects. I don't think it was the Back to the Future jokes. I don't think it was any of that. I think that the movie didn't resonate with audiences because it just isn't a cohesive, good movie. And I think that it was also in a very crowded marketplace. If you put this movie in the beginning of March, where there's little to nothing around it, maybe you draw in more people. But if you go down the list right now at your local multiplex, your options are as follows: Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Fast X, The Blackening. Let's see, what else? Elementals, Transformers, Rise of the Beast. All these other movies are right there for you to choose if you don't want to go see The Flash. And so, you know, you're overcrowded and the market's saturated to an extent, and this is what you get. I don't think it's a reaction to any of the auxiliary stuff. I just think it's a reaction to them just being like, this wasn't a good movie and I'm not going to waste my time on it. And word of mouth was poor, even with the Keaton stuff.
Yes. Like, word of mouth, we've been saying, it has been a strong indicator, but and they tried a lot of like getting people excited ahead of time with a bunch of these other screenings, the CinemaCon screening,
which was an unfinished cut.
And then they had those fan events and they showed it like 2 weeks, a week ahead of time. So I wonder if the word of mouth coming out of particularly those fan screenings, would that have helped it? Because everything I heard, it was just like the people that I knew were going to like the movie, really liked the movie. Everybody else was like, you know, it's fine. There wasn't a lot of buzz. It was just kind of like, you know, there.
It was kind of like, thank God this is finally out.
Kind of, yeah. So I don't know. But even with all that stuff, again, like me and you, we're like in this, so we know. But the general audience fan, they don't know about those fan screenings. They might hear something here or there about what people thought about it going in ahead of time, but they just didn't care. And WB put it in front of enough people. They spent a lot on marketing. They did the Super Bowl commercial, which they haven't done in years. Anytime there was a big event, they put the Flash right front and center. And again, and to go with that, I think it's a confluence of all these different things. You know, the Flash has been, the production has been troubled. The star has been troubled the last 2 years. They couldn't stick him in front of anybody if they couldn't stick them in front of anybody if they wanted to. With the writer strikes going, there's no traditional talk circuit to drum up any buzz. The movie's only good, not great. And the history of DC on film to date has been average to poor at best. I think that confluence, I don't think that hits our level. And I don't think all of that hits the general audience level. I think it hits somewhere like the people that are aware of movies but aren't as deep into it as us, that are kind of like the conduits to the general audience. I think it hits them. So many of those things hit them. Like, they might have missed one or two, but all of those things come together and they're like, eh. And then people that they know, they'll ask them about it, that, and they'll be like, I don't know. So I think it was a storm, kind of a perfect storm that sunk this movie. But it's really going to be like what comes next. How do you reach the general audience next? Because everything I just said, you can put it in front of them. They are not going to equate what comes next as something different. They'll just see it and be like, oh, it's a Superman movie. But I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you put you come up with yet another new DC logo and you say it's a Superman movie, and enough people know who Superman is that they'll at least peek at it or have some kind of awareness for it. Maybe that'll work. I don't know. But they have their work cut out for them to get people in the seats for Superman. And now it did before, but really now everything hinges on Superman. If that movie doesn't work, I actually don't know what they do as a studio. I don't know what they do with this IP outside of Batman, because it would have been your third Superman movie in 20 years, your second try at kickstarting something, and it just burned. And if it burns up out the gate, I think we're looking at, you shut all that other stuff down and it's just Batman from here on out, like it was for the better part of 25 years.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. James Gunn has brand recognition in and of himself, but that didn't help the Suicide Squad. Now, granted, the Suicide Squad was in the middle of a pandemic, but still, like, the brand awareness for Gunn himself is a trusted brand for the most part. So that lending that credibility to Superman in a rebirth project, if you will, will be something that I think will help. But it'll just be interesting, Nate, to me, because I don't trust Mr. Zasloff either. So, like,
that's true.
Like, the man almost killed TMC. Like, he almost killed Turner Classic Movies. And it's like, it took three legendary directors to be like, nah, bruh, let's not do this, for him to back off.
I'm glad they did it. I still don't like it. They need somebody there to actually curate, and curating is a job and a skill. They are directors. I appreciate them for doing it, but it's not their fault. It's Zasloff and his lack of respect, awareness for.
Well, you're what selling off do. The you're selling off the fanfare, man.
It's all about bottom line and money for them.
But Chad, here's my thing: like, AT&T possessed this property before the Discovery acquisition. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't see AT&T only had it for what, 18, 24 months?
Somewhere around there.
I can't possibly believe that the books were so tanked that in order to make any kind of serviceable profitability, you have to go to debt consolidation measures or revenue consolidation measures like what he's doing. I mean, he's selling off every asset that he has, not even at full value, just to try and bring revenue streams in. Like, that doesn't make sense to me unless you're just like completely broke. And I can't see the studio as a whole being in such debt that, like, if you'd have decided to take that debt on, like, you're a fool if it was this bad. Like there would have been a corporate accountant who would have gone over, a forensic accountant that would have gone over the books when the sale was being proposed. If the forensic accountant came back to you and said there's X amount of debt, and it was more debt than you wanted to accrue, or you thought you could turn around in less than 2 years, why did you agree to the merger?
So I think this is I think we need somebody that knows this kind of stuff better than us. But from my understanding of it, and I wish I remember where I saw this, but basically this is how venture capitalism works. And so what happens is that one of these companies buys a company, and they take on, they have that their company has debt already. They take on the new company's debt as well. And what they start doing is they start cutting stuff to trim up the company to make it again look better for stocks. And then somebody comes in and buys them for more, buys the cut up company for more than they paid for it, and takes all that debt with them. And they keep doing this thing. And Warner Brothers is the poster child for this, because a big company buys it, starts chopping stuff off, absorbs all of their debt, makes it look attractive for somebody else to come and pay more money for it. They come in and do the same process. And that's where we're at. So Warner Brothers had whatever debt it had before added to the AT&T debt that was then, you know, some of that debt was offloaded when they sold. AT&T kept some of the debt, but a lot of it would stay with Warner Brothers. So Discovery comes in with their own debt that they have.
So kind of similar to buyouts and coaches contracts.
Like
DiNardo had a buyout with Vandy to come to LSU, and Jodine refused to pay it. And so DiNardo had to pay Vandy to leave to go to LSU, and LSU never reimbursed him.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to, if you want the coach, you're going to take whatever their buyout is with them. So you take on that debt. So that's kind of what this is. They took
on. Yeah, because then you have to give them a new contract and also pay the guy that you just fired and pay the buyout for the guy you just hired.
Yeah, so you have all that debt together. It's just with the companies, whoever buys them, they're looking for the next seller. So they're going to start chopping stuff off so somebody else can come along, and they will still buy them, buy the new company that they've acquired for even more money, even though they still have to take on all that debt. So where we're at right now with Warner Brothers is they've got all this debt, so they've got to get it off the books to help get their stock prices back up. And that's why he's doing all these slasher moves. So it has nothing to do with value for the studio, the library, the catalog, any of that. It's about getting their books in order, so whenever that next buyer comes, they can go with it. But with that, I think Zasloff is smart enough to realize that a profitable DC makes Warner Brothers that much more valuable, which is why one of the few things that he's done that I think is good for the company is what he's done with DC, is by giving it to Gunn and Safran and making them their own separate thing. But they're still paying debts for that, and The Flash is another debt they have to pay for it. So it's the cost of doing business, but now they got so much work to do. And I still don't know what to do with these next two movies. And keep in mind that nothing I've heard about Aquaman makes it sound like it's going to be good.
And 2025 is a long time away.
Yeah, that is one thing working in their favor, is once they get past these two movies, there's a year and a half where they don't have anything coming out. That putting some space between stuff that came before and what's going to come next is going to be beneficial for them. But they're going to still have to put in work in doing stuff, and I don't know what they're going to do.
Indeed, it'll be interesting. So Chad's gonna do a solo podcast on the Superman casting announcements. So he can get that done at his leisure, where he can dive into his thoughts on the latest casting of Superman. Lois, no Nick Holt, although the Lex Luthor announcement hasn't been made, so might still be in the running for that. Mm-hmm. And check out Chad's podcast with his guys on the Man of Steel 10-year anniversary, as they take a deep dive and look back at the beginning of the DC expanded universe and one Zack Snyder and all the issues therein. So that definitely want to check that episode of the podcast out. It's really good. Chad and his friends provide a lot of detailed information and have a good back and forth, which is really good. So check both those things out and look out for this episode when it posts. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter.
Wait. One more thing.
Is there anything else? I don't.
No. You always kick me when I'm down, so I'm just going to nudge you a little bit. Brian, what's coming out tomorrow?
Well, yes, I'm excited about the fact that Mark Sanchez got married. I was not at the ceremony.
No.
But you're talking about the fedora hat guy, the bullwhip thing?
Why, yes, I am.
I have heard some variation thereof of either it is a fiery death pit of hell or it is the greatest Indiana Jones movie since Last Crusade. Like, there is no in between on this movie on my timeline. Like, everybody is either hair on fire, this is worse than Crystal Skull, or everybody's like Last Crusade. So I'll be interested to see it on Thursday tomorrow night for myself, because I spent today actually going through the journal, which is a great little short read through and covers a lot of the bases from the Young Indiana Jones TV series and the four movies. Also has some interesting thoughts in there about Atlantis, because he went off to search for the lost city of Atlantis for a little while, which is a little nugget that's in there that no one's ever picked up on. I see the promotion. I see Harrison Ford happy, which scares the hell out of me. But then again, this man loves this character. He detests every other character he plays, including Jack Ryan. But, like, he's okay with this one. He likes this one. You know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is out there talking about her Tomb Raider movie, which she's going to do now because she's written a Bond movie and a Indiana Jones movie. And she's taken those chips and put them on the table to do a Tomb Raider reboot again. You know, the Karen Allen thing is heartening to me because it she's in the movie. And that means that they are actually going to continue to they got married at the end of Crystal Skull. They're not going to do some kind of weird retcon where, like, Crystal Skull never happened. If it's like the other movies, there'll be references to Crystal Skull in it somewhere. Famous example being the Ark and Covenant in the warehouse where they did the chase at the beginning of Crystal Skull. There's a reference to Fortune and Glory also in Crystal Skull, which of course is from Temple of Doom. You know, it just, I'm excited. I have hope, which is a scary ass thing. This property means a lot to me for a number of reasons. One of which is that when I was at my grandparents' house as a kid growing up in a very religious home, they, you know, my options were either the Ten Commandments, the greatest story ever told, or Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, because my cousin had left a copy of the tape at my grandparents' house when he lived there, you know, for a few months. And so I watched the hell out of Last Crusade, man, and I got hooked on Indiana Jones because of my cousin and because of that. And then when Crystal Skull came out, I was in college, and I only ever went to the movies with my dad twice. My dad only took me to the movies twice. Once was Matrix Reloaded, in which he fell asleep in the loudest movie I've ever been in. Man, just like full out, like snoring in the middle of a theater that had me and two other people in it. And Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because I was a new driver at the time and he didn't want me out past midnight, you know, past 2 a.m. driving by myself. So he went. And that was his first and only midnight movie experience. And he complained the entire time about these crazy people dressing up as Indiana Jones and don't they have lives and something better to do and all of the things. And so it means a lot to me there, because I don't have a lot of those experiences with my dad. Because as much as I love my dad's never really shared my passion for film or really like taken a care to supporting that at all. So it means a lot that we got to share that experience together on that film. But like, I rewatched all four of the movies because they're now on Disney Plus. They are also on Paramount Plus. Like I said, we went through the journals today. Really looking forward to it and hopeful that I can actually get, you know, a good Indiana Jones movie before old man Harrison dies.
Well, I hope it turns out well for you. I still don't know when I'm going to see it. I probably won't see it until next week.
Well, it is tracking for a good opening weekend, which is also a positive sign.
Yeah. I because I don't care as much as you do, I did kind of read some things, and I can tell you that there are definite references to Crystal Skull.
Yeah, because you can't ignore it completely.
Right.
Especially considering if they're throwing him a retirement party when they fired him because they thought he was a communist. Like, he had to, like, his whole negotiation with the government for not telling people about extraterrestrial beings was that they would take him off the FBI's watch list of commies and that they would reinstate him at the University of Chicago. And so that's how he gets his tenured professorship at the end of Crystal Skull. So, and it's very clear in this movie that he's retiring from lecturing. So, throwing a retirement party for a guy you fired, it's interesting. But that'll about do it for this week's episode of the Movies on the Brain podcast. If you want to keep up on this podcast, you can follow me at BCW Tiger Fan.
At The Mets Theory.
And thank you very much. And Mark, your wedding gift is on the way. Got it off your register. Talk to you later.
Bye, guys.